It is indeed that time here on KKOJ on a Friday morning. This time we have Jackson EMS Chief Grant Lambeau alongside. Thank you very much for making the time and coming in.
Always a pleasure.
A one-year anniversary to celebrate here today. ALS, which is Advanced Life Support, right? That's the acronym there for the Jackson service. And so maybe take us back to the beginning, potentially, even for you of the transition there.
Sure. So, it's about the one-year mark of when we did our first in-house advanced life support transfer with our own staff. So I wanted to get on here, talk a little bit about just everything that's transitioned in the last little while, kind of end with ALS because that's kind of like the biggest thing and the most impactful, I think, to our community. But talking about different transitions with staffing, policies, procedures, you know, this story really starts all the way back in November 2021, and that's not something a lot of people know. So back in November of 2021, that is when the organization changed its name from Jackson Volunteer Ambulance Service to Jackson Ambulance Service. And the reason why that was changed is because at that time, Jackson Ambulance Service, you know, became a full city department. Any of the employees that were working at the ambulance department became city employees. And at that time, their pay structure, so being paid hourly for on-call and a different hourly rate when working versus stipend pay and the pay amounts, how much these people were making per year, it exceeded the definition outlined by the Minnesota Office of EMS for volunteer. So in the eyes of the state, we could no longer call these employees volunteer because they qualified as staff members. And that's important, you know, and that led to the name change and whatnot, because if we had continued to call ourselves a volunteer organization, you know, one could argue that that would be fraudulent, because volunteer EMS organizations in the state of Minnesota are eligible for different tax credits. They can get tuition reimbursement for their staff. There's just a whole host of things that you're eligible for if you're a volunteer organization and you meet that definition. And because we no longer met that definition legally, we had to make that change. So, and that goes all the way back to 2021. So at that point, folks that had historically been classified as a volunteer were now considered casual employees, meaning that for the most part, their schedule was on-call shifts where they could work from their home if they lived within 7 minutes of the station. And then if they responded to a call, went to training, things like that, they'd get a higher hourly wage. We still employ a good amount of those folks today. They're on the city's grade and step wage schedule. So they have annual performance reviews. They're eligible for cost of living adjustments. So I mean, these are full-blown city staff members. And I guess a good comparison with how this pay structure and benefits have been modernized would be, you know, if the hospital, local hospital, they have phlebotomists, nurses, different staff members that are eligible to work on-call shifts from home, and they get a different on-call shift rate than they do when they're actually working, you know, those aren't referred to as volunteer phlebotomists or nurses. Those are casual employees, you know. And so that's what we have. And I think that's an important distinction because, you know, people are under the belief that when myself and Elijah started to make some changes to our staffing, that these things were brand new and that, you know, the volunteer workforce ended last year and that we had hired the first paid staff. But, you know, the ambulance service had full-time and part-time staff back prior to 2021. So we added to that current roster.
Something I've heard you talk about as well is the level of kind of, you know, regulation, legalese, red tape that comes with your industry in particular, but that also has to do with the risk. I've heard you make that point, and, you know, that comes with compliance as well.
Correct. So it's really twofold. I mean, we are arguably the most regulated aspect of healthcare that exists. And a lot of that is because we're such an oddball. you know, we conduct our work in healthcare in vehicles traveling down roadways. So federally, on paper, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration oversees EMS in America. But in reality, what they do is they gather every, you know, 10 years or so, and they come up with a national scope of practice, and they come up with national education guidelines and you know, vision for EMS in 2030 and things like that. But they say, you know, here's the national expectation, but it's up to each state to decide if they want to do that. It's up to each state to decide how they want to administer EMS. So here in Minnesota, every EMS organization, so like Jackson Ambulance Service, Lakefield Ambulance Service, they hire their own medical director. So we have a medical director that's paid by us. Everything's kind of done in-house. Different states like Illinois, EMS is managed by Illinois Department of Public Health. They split the state into different regions. Each region has a hospital that oversees the EMS in that region. The hospital hires the medical director, the administrators, the, you know, quality control people, and then your ambulance service reports to them. And a lot of that's done, one, to keep costs down, because you don't have to hire your own medical director, you're provided one. And then two, it just eliminates a lot of conflict of interest. You know, if you have a medical director who's supposed to be one of the people regulating you and they're on your payroll, like, that's a little bit of a conflict. But anyway, to bring it back, because we really lack in reality one federal regulator, we're pretty much regulated by everybody. So our narcotics license for pain medication, sedation, that's managed by the DEA. You know, different HIPAA compliance things are managed by Office of Civil Rights and Department of Justice. Our Medicare funds are administered by you know, CMS, Centers for Medicaid, and the Department of Justice, because that's the, you know, arm that goes punitive if you do things wrong. You know, we're managed by OSHA. It kind of goes on and on and on. And so a lot of this change that's occurred and the rate of speed in which things changed at a procedural and policy level and why different just things that people were used to changed is because we were not compliant with these things. And we had to move fast because every day that myself or the deputy chief or anybody else is aware of things that are illegal, we're doing things in an illegal manner, every single day we're aware of that is a liability. And so we have to address those things as aggressively and quickly as possible. And a lot of these things were small, right? I mean, it was you have to have two forms of locking barriers between patient care records and the public. So, you know, an office that was historically unlocked was locked when administrators weren't there. And then the records were in a locked filing cabinet. So two locks. You know, a lot of these things were very, very simple, you know, easy changes, but just it had to be done by law. And so where we stand now, you know, we were also on probation with the state because we were unable to staff our schedule. So there were times in which there were not two people assigned to an ambulance. And so had someone called 911 at those times, granted, never happened, thank God. But had someone called 911, there wouldn't have been a fully staffed ambulance that showed up. And not only is it illegal, it's wrong. And so where we stand now is we got off probation in October of last year. That's another good 1 year anniversary. The state released us from probation. They believe that, you know, we'd address the issue. They were impressed by the rate of speed and seriousness in which we were addressing the compliance issues. We've done internal audits. We've had external audits done by our lawyers to kind of test our compliance with different HIPAA regulations and Medicare billing and whatnot. That's all been completed for an extended period. We didn't have a Medicare license, so we were unable to bill Medicare for patients that we transported. We got that back in September last year. So a lot was done very rapidly, but it got us off the heat quickly. And something that's important for people to understand is a lot of these regulatory bodies, with the exception of the Minnesota Office of EMS, they don't come in and do a annual or bi-yearly checkup. You know, so it's not like Office of Civil Rights comes in every 2 years and they say, hey, you know, this is out of compliance. This is what you can do to address it, because how many different organizations would they have to go to? So, you know, along the way, they're just people honestly didn't know that these things were out of compliance, and nobody externally was coming in to say, hey, you need to address this. And that's completely understandable, you know. But it's fixed now, and that's good, because should anything ever happen, there's an accusation that we've breached a HIPAA rule. You know, we've got these internal, external audits and written policies that demonstrate that we're making a best faith effort to mitigate that. So
change can be very hard, and the devil's in the details is one of those things you hear all the time. And so that is a couple, those are a couple things that popped into my head when you were talking about that and laying that out. I appreciate you saying that, because the way I kind of look at that, you know, the devil is in the details. That's where it comes from sometimes. And sometimes that making those changes that you were talking about, even the little ones, especially when there's a lot of them, can be difficult for sure. And so speaking of changes and defining things, especially when it comes to the conversation we're having, what is ALS and how does it compare to maybe alternatives or something else?
Sure. So there's two levels of service in which a ambulance service can be licensed by the state, and that is basic life support, which is going to be two EMTs or an EMT and an EMR. And then there is advanced life support. And an advanced life support ambulance has to have at least one paramedic on it. And the difference between the two is pretty wide. So at a basic life support level, you know, it's basic airway interventions, some really basic life-saving medications, you know, splinting and stabilization, C-spine stabilization, things like that. The focus is primarily on very gross stabilization and then rapid transport. Whereas when you transition to advanced life support, the focus becomes more on stopping the problem at hand and then having a controlled transport to the hospital. Granted, there's always going to be things that are time sensitive that we can't address in the field, things like a stroke, right? So if we show up, whether ALS, BLS, we show up for a suspected stroke, we're going to do a stroke assessment. It takes about 30 seconds. We're going to check that person's blood sugar, and if there is any indication, if that stroke screen comes back positive, any of the different metrics that we measure, we stop what we're doing. There's no more interventions. We want to get that person in the ambulance. We want to get them to the hospital, because there's nothing that we can do in either of our care to stop the problem at hand, which is, you know, the death of brain tissue. But then you think of things like asthma. We have a decent amount of people that live in our primary service area with asthma. Asthma attacks can be lethal. I mean, it's when someone has a severe asthma attack, it is a very serious issue. And so I like to use asthma attacks as a way to demonstrate the difference between BLS and ALS, because it's pertinent to our community and it really showcases what we can do. So at a basic life support level, they can administer a nebulizer, CPAP, which is continuous positive pressure. It's like looks like a jet fighter mask. Mm-hmm. And it just basically provides positive pressure and allows that person some assistance to get the breath in, but it's not breathing for them. And then they can give a nebulizer with albuterol, which, you know, that patient's usually prescribed albuterol and they've tried administering it to themselves and it's not working, and that's why they've called you. So usually that's going to be futile, but we're going to do it anyway, and then quickly get that person to the ER where they can do more advanced interventions. On the flip side, an advanced life support ambulance is going to begin to treat that person's asthma where they find them. So if you're, you know, sitting up in bed, if you're sitting on the couch, wherever we find you, we're going to begin to do things. So if you're having a severe asthma attack, we're also going to do the CPAP and the NEB. Those are just easy things to quickly throw on. But then we're going to give you an injection into the muscle in your upper thigh of epinephrine. That's going to open up your airways. We're going to start an IV. We're going to give magnesium in the IV, which is a smooth muscle relaxant. You know, your bronchi are smooth muscle. It's in your lungs. And that's constricted. You know, the asthma attack is all those different airways are constricted. So the magnesium is going to start to loosen that up. Once we finish that magnesium infusion, we're going to put you on a corticosteroid to further reduce that inflammation. So there is a lot of very aggressive, very advanced things happening quickly where we find you, because, you know, within that scope of practice, we can pretty much eliminate that asthma attack. And then, you know, if things were to progress further and we need to do something like intubate the patient and begin providing ventilations for them, they go into respiratory failure, you know, that's within the scope of practice too. So that's really the difference. And then, you know, trauma, Studies have shown, there's been a lot of studies shown, demonstrated a difference between BLS, ALS. And so for the most part, in a medical patient in pre-hospital, there's better survivability if they receive ALS care. Trauma, it doesn't really make a difference in survivability, and that's because whether you're an EMR, EMT, or paramedic, you're not a trauma surgeon. We can't address the problem at hand. However, there's an aspect of comfort. So if you're badly burned or badly injured, you know, paramedics can address that. Our local hospital is not a trauma center. They lost their trauma credential previous to me arriving. So it's been a little over a year and a half, I believe. But what that means for the ambulance service is we cannot legally take a trauma patient to our local hospital. We are required to take them to a trauma center if we can get there within 30 minutes. So from most parts of our primary service area, we can get to Fairmont, Worthington, or Lakes Regional within 30 minutes. So we have an obligation under the law to take that person there. And so you're looking at a 25 or 30 minute transport. So if that's you know, a 9-year-old kid that goes off the handlebars of their bicycle and they break their arm and they've got bones sticking through the skin, I mean, that on a BLS ambulance, that kid's going to be sitting on our stretcher looking at their arm, screaming in pain for 25 minutes to the hospital because we legally can't take them here. On an advanced life support ambulance, we can sedate that patient. We can do a little bit of conscious sedation, which isn't going to decrease their respirations. We can give them pain medication so they're nice, comfortable, relaxed. They don't have to go through that, you know? And so while ALS doesn't, there's no proof that it increases survivability in burns or trauma, there's a big aspect of comfort care, you know? Pain management is part of healthcare. It's important. And because we have to take these people further than we historically did, it's very important that we have staff that are qualified to do that.
Just sitting here trying to kind of soak it in as you tell me about it. It sounds like it kind of heads off one of those unique challenges or some of those unique challenges, maybe multiple, to running, especially a rural type ambulance service and stuff like that. So that in theory to me sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. And then the other important thing too, is with these paramedics, we can provide both advanced life support transfers and SCT, which is specialty care transports. So what that means is, you know, patients that historically would have had to fly out of this hospital can now go by ground in certain circumstances. And we live in rural Minnesota. The weather is not always conducive to flying. And so there's been transfers where we're given medications like norepinephrine, which is a pressor. We use that to try to increase somebody's blood pressure. We've given multiple inter-hospital transfers where that person is being administered whole blood. So that's something we can do with paramedics. We can do blood infusions while we're on the road. For that stroke patient that's being treated with TPA, which is like anticoagulant, you know, paramedics can transport that. So there's also, you know, a lot of the focus is on the pre-hospital. That's our mission as a government-based ambulance service, is to respond to 911 calls. But when we have the ability to and the staff to take on additional services like transfers, you know, it really allows us to do more for the people that live here and go to this hospital when they need to be transferred out.
Well, I appreciate you sharing about all that we've covered today and all that knowledge that you've been able to drop on us here today. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks.
That's EMS Chief Grant Lambeau telling us all about it, ALS and all that good stuff, everything that we covered. Appreciate that. And thank you out there for listening as well to The Morning Juice.